And good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Court of Appeals, December 9. I'll ask the marshal to introduce the panel, and then I will introduce the case, and we'll begin. So if the marshal would please begin, you may do so.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Jessen, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And good morning, and welcome to both councils. Good to see you both, although in a virtual method, which we are proceeding on and have been for some time. Our process otherwise, though, is pretty much what you're familiar with in terms of appellate. We will allow 15 minutes for appellant's counsel, and hopefully you can see the time clock in one of the boxes on the screen, and then 15 minutes for respondent's counsel, and then appellant will be allowed 5 minutes of rebuttal. I'll note for the record that this is the second of two oral arguments we have this morning, and then we have four non-oral arguments for our panel to consider. This is file A-20-0330, Amy Jo Urick, now known as Amy Jo Sellers, as petitioner respondent. Michael Francis Urick is the appellant. If for some reason at any time during our oral argument that we lose hearing from either counsel, we'll of course instruct the marshal to stop the clock. We'll wait till the technology is improved so that we can properly hear you and ideally see you as well, which right now it appears to be working, so that we can complete the arguments. We are recording these proceedings as we normally do of all appellate arguments pursuant to judicial branch policy, so any other recording is prohibited. And what we do ask is that counsel, as you begin your presentation, if you would state your name for our record. And so we will begin with counsel for appellant. Mr. Olson, you may proceed.
Good morning, Justice. My name, as you know, is Brian Olson. I'm an attorney in Cokato, Minnesota, representing Michael Urick, who I have listening in the background. And this particular case involves a farm which is on the very northern fringe of McLeod County as it abuts the very southern fringe of Wright County. And this farm has been in the Urick family probably since the 1800s. His father, Florian Urick, and his mother and his sister were the occupants. During the years before this relationship, which is being litigated, that family was able to survive on the farm without any significant debt. The farm was, they pretty much worked part-time off the farm. They had absolutely no credit debt. They paid their real estate taxes on time. They did not even believe in buying an item of substance without the cash on hand. In about 1998, the respondent, Ms. Sellers, essentially joined the family unit, which became she, Mr. Urick, and Florian, the father. During the initial period of time they were together until Florian Urick's death in about 2002, the expenses on the farm were held in check. And essentially, the same thing was going on. Nobody was using credit debt, and nobody was running up things that they couldn't pay for. What happened is Mr. Urick, Florian, died. And, you know, so part of why they needed to get a loan at the date of his death was that they had quite a funeral for Mr. Florian Urick. And also, the farm, they had a life estate. So Mr. Urick, years prior through, I think me, created a life estate for his children after his wife died. And so at the
Mr.
same
Mr. Olson, time, if I may, I just wanted to ask you a question about that just to make sure I'm clear on the record. When Florian conveyed the life estate to your client, it was
he had a remainder. Sorry to interrupt. Okay. But he
or
had
not a life estate. Sorry, he had a remainder, yeah.
Yeah.
And your client had a half interest in the property,
that is correct.
Correct. So at the time of Florian's death, your client's interest was only half of the property.
That is correct.
So then how did the district court err in concluding that that his interest in the property, his non-marital interest in the property was a portion of the property, not the entire property?
Here's the problem.
Given the definition of non-marital property.
What I was about to get to, and I will answer that question, but what happened is this. Mary Urich gave a bargain price because of wanting the farm to remain in the family. Obviously, the equity of that farm, of that 50% interest at the time of Florian's death was not $25,000. And Ms. Uncheski, now Ms. Urich again, testified below that was her intent to keep the farm and the family. And the other thing that shows that was that the Citizens Bank of Hutchinson was approached to finance primarily the funeral and some improvements around the home. And what happened is that they told these parties that she had to be on the title, she meaning Ms. Sellers, because they were going to mortgage the property. They mortgaged it for more than what the value was, and they gave a credit card to these people. And essentially, the debt on the farm pretty much, for want of a better term, took off from that point. And so what proves it is the testimony of the people themselves. Both, I think at pages 92 and 93 of the transcript, Ms. Sellers, now Ms. Sellers, testified that indeed the title was put that way for the convenience of the bank because of the loan they made and that she would have to sign the note. Everybody agreed to that. And there's documentary proof of this too, because referring to exhibits numbered 10, 11, 13, and 13A, they were all recorded simultaneously on the same day, back to back to back to back. And where were they returned? Ordinarily, a deed is returned to the vendee, the buyer. Where were those documents returned? They were returned to the Citizens Bank of Hutchinson for their file, which is additional proof. You know, so it's undisputed, you know, the testimony of both parties and the documentary evidence show that it's a premarital and a non-marital property. What's
Mr. Olson, I just want to ask you a follow-up question then. I think I understand your argument about the intent, but looking at the definition of non-marital property, I'm not sure how your argument fits in with that definition. In other words, your argument that it was the intent that it remain in the with husband, how does that fit in the definition, the transfer from sister to husband and wife? How does that fit in the definition of non-marital property in Minnesota statute 518.003?
It was simultaneously with the mortgage by the bank. You know, the bank required it. Everything took place simultaneously because the bank wanted it to happen. And
I guess, look, can you point me to the language in the statute that you think this situation fits in terms of being non-marital property?
I believe that I can point to the evidence, which I've been pointing to, and where they all agreed that it was titled this way for convenience sake. The record is undisputed in that particular method. I will like to go on to the permanent spousal maintenance issue. Permanent spousal maintenance, talking about referring to the statute on the standard of living maintained during the marriage. It was a disaster. It was, you know, the trial judge made a finding that my client had discretionary income of $800 to $1,000 a month. You know, discretionary income when there's judgments against them being levied, discretionary income when real estate taxes weren't paid from 2014 through and including the current date. you know, people that honor their bills, that are proud of their reputation in the community for paying their bills, don't pay them. My client quits the farm and works 40, 50 hours a week just to keep his nose above the waterline. And they call that discretionary income when there's debt.
Mr. Olson?
Yeah.
And correct, you know the record better than I do, so correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the court relying in part on your client's testimony at trial, where he could, you know, talk about being able to cut down on his monthly expenses? Wasn't that part of the consideration?
Indeed, Justice, we, you know, I think he would have gone down and, you know, my client, if Mr. Scotting would have asked him further, he could have probably gotten to agree that he could live on 50 cents if he had to. You know, the point of view is, what's the common sense logic? What's the standard of living that's been established during this marriage? They're living in a house that needs to be pushed down. It's still uninhabitable, you know? So, and what about the ability of Mr. Urich to meet his expenses, you know, pay child support and pay her $600 a month now, and increasing to, increasing to $1,000 a month in another year and a half with absolutely no justification. And where is the thought process regarding $130,000 non-marital asset that was awarded to the respondent? You know, my client didn't make any claim against that particular asset, even though marital funds were devoted to. Why isn't that factored into the marital prior to the into the maintenance calculation?
You know, Mr. Olson, can I follow up on the spousal maintenance? One of the arguments you appear to make is that and this is my praise, her profligate spending. You talked about wasteful spending and matters such as that. Now, I don't recall seeing specific findings by the court, but let's just presume for a moment that there was. Is there any legal authority that would therefore be a abuse of discretion to order maintenance as the court did?
Well, you know, we have everybody agreeing that there is the Experian showing that she still, in spite of all of the digging, eating into the equity, it showed that there was still $80,000 of credit card debt or in Experian, in the Experian credit report accounts. And so, you know, that is uncontested also. And also, the respondent testified that she had nothing to show for any of these expenses, you know, because it was all wasted money. And I think I had a case I cited, not exactly on point, my case of Pettit versus Pettit years ago, where they had lump sum spousal maintenance. In effect, she's eaten up $150,000 of the equity of the farm and with nothing to show for it. But in effect, I think that's lump sum spousal maintenance. And, you know, continuing on, the other factor you have to look at all of this as a whole. So over and above the non-marital and the spousal maintenance permanent, we have a marital lien that's established on the property. And where does the trial court factor in to the spousal maintenance calculation the payment of that marital lien as it affects the ability of Ms. Sellers to maintain her lifestyle? You know, are we going to have her maintain a profligate lifestyle? Does my client, is he responsible for that spending still beyond the divorce, beyond the separation? You know, so in essence, Your Honor, you know, that wasn't factored in. So, I mean,
Mr. Olson, regarding that point, that your client's ability to pay the lien, it appears to me that the district court actually did consider that on page A12 of your appendix, paragraph 5 of the conclusions of law of the district court's order. It says, respondent has discretionary income of $800 to $1,100. The court is not awarding all of the discretionary income to petitioner, who's the wife in the proceeding below, as spousal maintenance, as respondent will have to prove to Compeer and Wells Fargo that he's able to refinance the mortgage and the LOC to remove petitioner's name therefrom and be able to pay petitioner her share of the marital assets. And the court wants to ensure he is able to do this. So it appears to me the court did consider your client's ability to pay off the lien.
Well, you know, did they consider that they owed $15,000 from 5 years of real estate taxes? Did the court consider? This is all did they consider that he spent 3 years with a judgment being garnished for about $700 a month? That was a run up on a credit card for another credit agency. You know, there's all, you know, look at his income, look at his expenses, you know. He put a bare bones number down. And so the judge finds as fact a taunt that counsel made to my client. You know, maybe I should have interrupted. I eventually interrupted it. Like I say, the taunt could have got him down to about $50 a month. You know, is that what you should base your judgment on and your findings? How can the whole thing stand as it is? You know, I can see where this could be affirmed in part and reversed in part, because, you know, what do you need spousal maintenance if you're getting all this money from? What do you need spousal maintenance if you got a house that is your prior, it's awarded to you, free and clear of my client, that's worth $130,000? You know, so those things were not weighed. And it's a question of law regarding spousal maintenance. And I guess I'm down to my last 20 seconds. And so, but sorry to get so wound up, but thank you.
Very well. And you'll have the 5 minutes of rebuttal as well, Mr. Olson, if you choose. And so, Mr. Scotting, you may identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Troy Scotting, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Amy Sellers, formerly known as Amy Urich. The first issue, the homestead, I believe it's undisputed that respondent's father conveyed a 1/2 interest to, petitioner or appellant's father conveyed a 1/2 interest to appellant and a 1/2 interest to appellant's sister, reserving a life estate for himself. The parties were married in 2000. Appellant's father passed away in 2001. So at that point, appellant owned a 1/2 interest and his sister owned a 1/2 interest. The 1/2 interest owned by appellant, that would be partly marital and partly non-marital, because the parties used marital funds to pay towards the loan on that interest. In 2002, the parties purchased a 1/2 interest from appellant's sister. That 1/2 interest would be 100% marital. Minnesota statutes 508B.003, property acquired during the marriage is presumed to be marital. There was no evidence or argument even at trial by appellant that the 1/2 interest purchased from the sister was somehow non-marital or that it was purchased before the marriage. There was no evidence or argument that it was a gift. Today is the first time that I'm hearing from counsel that they believe that it was sold at a bargain price. There's no cites to the record for any of that. Quite simply, there's nothing in the record to support that. So because the farm is part marital, part non-marital, the district court's decision should be affirmed with respect to that issue. I just don't see any facts to support appellant's arguments. The second argument was that the trial court erred by awarding permanent spousal maintenance to my client. We look at 518.552. The court may grant maintenance if a party lacks sufficient property to provide for their reasonable needs or they're unable to provide adequate self-support. The district court in this case determined that my client was in need of maintenance in order to pay her monthly expenses. So the court ordered $600 per month, which would increase to $1,000 after the appellant's child support obligation ends. And this was a permanent order. The evidence at trial established that my client's income from Social Security, a Social Security child benefit, and the child support is $1,603 per month. Her monthly expenses, determined to be reasonable by the district court, were $2,445. So she has a monthly shortfall of $842. The appellant's income in 2019 from his one employer was $5,083 per month. He also had additional income from renting out farmland, which in 2019 was $18,000. And I believe it was referenced earlier, the district court did look at both his income and expenses. Finding of fact number 14 determined that from his one job, he had net income of $3,172 per month. The court also looked at his expenses. And although the court didn't say, here's what his reasonable expenses were, the court did indicate they believed he had discretionary income of between $800 and $1,100 per month. And that's based
Sir
off
Scotting,
of, yes.
Is that finding sufficiently detailed to uphold the award of spousal maintenance?
I believe so. One of the things I was going to present was in his exhibit number 63, he indicated that he had monthly expenses of $3,280. However, there was evidence at trial where he indicated he wasn't paying $500 a month to his attorney and that there was a $420 payment to Compere that he acknowledged, the appellant acknowledged, should be taken off of his monthly expenses.
The attorney expense, though, isn't that a valid expense that he needs to pay, just as your client included her attorney's fee expense in her list of expenses, I believe?
As an attorney, I would have to say, yeah, it's a valid expense. I think $500 is extremely excessive as a monthly payment. And I kind of go through in my brief some of the expenses that he detailed on there, but my brief analysis was that if you have $3,280 and you subtract off the attorney's fees of $500 and you subtract off the $420 Compere payment, which should be subtracted because it's covered by his land rental income, mm-hmm. that leaves his net income at monthly expenses as $2,360, which is in that range that the judge said his monthly expenses were. So is it a perfect finding? No, but I think by doing some reverse, looking at it from a reverse angle, I see how she did it and how she got there.
I have an additional related question for you. It's not clear to me that the judge considered the award of marital property in determining your client's ability to meet her monthly expenses. And appellant cites the Rask v. Rask case for the proposition that to argue that the district court should have done so. Do you have a response to that argument?
The main response I would have is contained in the brief that I cite the Fink case and the Curtis case that respondent should not be required to use assets awarded to her for support purposes. Further, that a party is not required to liquidate assets awarded to them in order to provide for their support. I didn't go into great detail beyond that. It's been my understanding that, yeah, if she was awarded property that produced income for her, then that income should be considered. But none of the assets that she's being awarded produce any income for her. So I would just agree with the cases that indicate she should not have to liquidate marital assets awarded to her to provide for her support.
Thank you.
Mr. Scotting, would you agree that with regard to attorney fees, it seemed the court focused or assumed your client had a need, but focused solely on appellant's ability to pay. What from the record would indicate there was an abuse of discretion in the court's ruling in that regard?
So this is the cross appeal, I assume?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
I realize there was no written argument, and but I wanted to raise that question since we must look at the record to make that determination.
So I'll be honest with you in the sense that I did brief the issue. I cited to the record for some things. However, when I received the order indicating that that it would be decided on the merits, I assumed it was not going to be argued here today. So I honestly, I did not prep for that argument.
That's fine. If you're satisfied, your brief speaks for itself. We'll review that again in the record. Thank you.
The issue that I believe I was on was the spousal maintenance issue. The court determined, and I think rightfully so, that he had the ability to pay between $800 and $1,100 per month. She only ordered $600 per month. I believe it's important to note that this is just net income from his one job. This did not include any sort of analysis from the court to look at the appellant's income from renting out the farmland, which there would be more discretionary income there as well.
Well, Mr. Scotting, on that point, doesn't the record reflect that the income from the farm is variable depending on crop prices? So is it fair to assume that there's always going to be additional income available from the renting of the farm?
I don't recall specifically what the record would have indicated, but I do agree with what you indicated, that there is a lot of variability. I do know that in 2019, it was rented out for $19,000 in gross income. I know that the record indicates that the appellant testified he could rent it out this year for a net income, which is after all expenses, of $22,000. So there is a significant increase when you consider $19,000 gross income compared to a $22,000 net income moving forward.
It also appears to me that the Wells Fargo mortgage wasn't really factored into that, and that's another obligation that husband has.
Into his monthly expenses?
Correct.
Okay. I believe the court in their findings of fact did discuss that.
I agree with that, but in his list of expenses, I don't see that there.
In looking at the exhibit, it does not appear that it was in there, no. However, I would just indicate that it seemed to me from the court's finding that they took that into account.
I think that's true in the finding conclusion of law 5 on page 812. The court did consider that.
Correct. Thank you. I really didn't focus a lot on the standard of living that the parties had during the marriage. I didn't think it was extremely relevant. From my perspective, my client, her request doesn't really have anything to do with the standard of living. The spousal maintenance request and the spousal maintenance ordered is simply so that she can cover basic monthly expenses. So I just didn't take the perspective that standard of living during the marriage was overly or extremely relevant to this. The duration of the order, permanent, I believe that's supported by the fact that there's a 19-year marriage. My client's income is severely limited due to the disability. I would cite subdivision 3 of 518.552, which indicates if there's any uncertainty, the court should order permanent maintenance, leaving it open for future modification. I believe my client fits squarely into the 518.552, both categories as the court could award spousal maintenance. I think that the amount ordered and the duration are both appropriate, despite the fact that the amount is less than what we were asking for. I don't think it's an abuse of discretion in terms of what the district court did. There was some brief argument regarding the homestead that my client was awarded. She was awarded a non-marital home. I would just note for the court that that's not 100% her home. It's half hers, half her sister's, and I believe the district court's order did spell that out. In the minute and 20 seconds I have left, the last argument was that there was an abuse of discretion regarding the lien placed on the homestead. His primary argument seems to be that my client's not entitled to an award of anything because she had significant spending problems. But the evidence at trial actually establishes that both parties spent money, both parties had credit cards, both used credit cards, that the cards were used to purchase basic necessities. My client applied for credit cards at appellant's request, and respondent, my client made purchases on credit cards at the request of appellant. The appellant acknowledged at trial that he has no idea how much credit card debt there was during the marriage, and he has no idea how much credit card debt was refinanced into the home loans. So the court's determination of values and the division was not an abuse of discretion. Nobody disputed values. I would also just finish by saying that placing a lien on the marital home to secure payment of my client's award of the marital assets was not an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scotting. And Mr. Olson, you will be allotted 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose, and so you may proceed.
Thank you. Chomping at the bit. The argument, the most egregious argument, was the fact that there was no testimony on the record to establish the fact that there was a gift transaction from my client's sister to him. The undisputed record was that the equity value of the farm at the time of the marriage was $533,000, and the lien was $48,000, making $480,000 of equity. Half of that is $240,000. And so $25,000 does not equal $240,000. Also, you know, maybe I should be checking malpractice premiums, but I didn't put in expenses for payment of anything that wasn't being paid except for my legal fees. You know, there's the real estate taxes aren't being paid as we sit here today, and they're still accumulating. You know, the farm will have to eventually be sold. Another argument which is misleading is the rent on the property. You know, right now, Wells Fargo is in a tough position. They're a second, and they don't want to have to take this farm with a house in ruinous condition and foreclose and have to pay off Compere to be first on the property. And so essentially what they're doing is laying in wait to see what happens in this case, in this appeal. But the testimony below was Mr. Urich indicated that the rental property went 100%, the farm rent, that's the only rent, went 100% to pay Compere to keep them happy on the first mortgage, you know, so they wouldn't start foreclosure proceedings. But that wasn't enough. And so what I put in for his payment, they needed another $5,000 last year, you know, on the record to keep him straight. So they had all the 100% of the rental plus another $5,000. That's why I put $425 a month on the average 12 divided by 5,000. So, you know, those are, and then with reference to Ms. Sellers, you know, I presume she's talking about mortgage payments or something in her expenses. She's got free living. And also she's on Social Security. If anything happens, she's entitled to rental for a fraction of the market rate. And so that was never factored in. It was testified to. And with reference to my client and the use of credit cards, he didn't all of a sudden become a different person when he married this individual. He was still Florian Urich's son the son that wanted to pay debt before it came due. His problem was he couldn't control his wife. And so it went and she and mortgaged on the equity of the farm. And so, you know, he used credit only sparingly. And once again, he was garnished for a year and a half on the wife's debt because she's judgment proof. You know, the creditor didn't want to garnish her. You know, there's all other debts that he's going to pick up in our point of view. So, I mean, it should be, I don't see how the whole of this judgment can stand. You know, the way it is, it's so horribly one-sided. You know, it's, you know, there was an incident, you know, where he was removed from the home. And I can't help but think that the judge was factoring fault into her equation, because what else can justify making him essentially have to work 50 hours a week and come home and pay everything and then pay her his so-called discretionary income when there's no discretionary income? Nothing was being paid. You know, real estate taxes would be paid if there was discretionary income. Credit cards, the Wells Fargo mortgage would be paid if there was discretionary income. The only reason that they're still out there is that they don't want to foreclose and pay off Compeer. So, you know, it's a mess. And essentially, the only way that's going to happen if this judgment stands is to sell off the farm. And that farm's been in the family for over 100 years, as we've indicated. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, both counsel. We appreciate your comments today and answers to our questions, as well as the briefing. We will take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days. You each have a great day. We will be adjourning to consider our non-